Having a baby is usually the happiest time of many parents' lives. But for mums on the Darling Downs in southern Queensland, the turnover of maternity staff has many mums worried whether or not they'll be able to give birth locally.
To have the fall down in care, quality of care that is given, not meet the, fear factor they put into you as a mother, that's quite distressing as well.
And what comes to mind when you hear volcano disc golf? Golf buggies, flying discs, bubbling lava. Well, there's a sport being played inside an ancient volcanic crater.
Even locals who've never heard of it think that the baskets are rubbish bins. So, and you know, explaining how it all works. So, yeah, it's good to see even some spectators out who are just locals seeing it for the first time.
You'll hear more about that very unique sport soon. I'm Jessica Hinchliffe, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from the traditional lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. We start today in South Australia, where a toxic algal bloom has been devastating coastal ecosystems and communities for months now. The bloom first made headlines in March when dead octopus and fish started washing up on beaches. Since then, scientists have been working around the clock trying to understand the disaster, and now they've had a breakthrough. Our reporter Caroline Horn has been following the story. Caroline, what do scientists think is behind the toxins in the bloom?
Yeah, so what they have been able to find is that there's actually five different Karenia species of algae within the bloom, and they've been able to pinpoint which one it is that is producing the brevetoxins, which are the things that can accumulate, you know, in shellfish and things like that and have a devastating effect and unfortunately have led to some areas, not all, but some areas of oyster harvesting being closed in South Australia for some time.
There's that word that keeps coming up in this story, that brevetoxins. Exactly what is that?
So brevetoxins are an algal toxin and they're produced by some algal species. And so really they can be responsible when they accumulate in shellfish for poisoning and things like that. So obviously there's a lot of testing and monitoring that goes on to make sure that any of the shellfish that are for sale are safe and cleared and from unaffected areas. But yet, basically, as it sounds like a toxin that the algae can produce, what this what the researchers have worked hard to do is to really pinpoint and say we know that they knew that the brevetoxin was being produced, but they didn't know which algal species was producing it.
And has this appeared, has it appeared in Australia before?
No. So this algal species is known as Karenia cristata, and so it has never been detected in Australia before. It's been detected off the coast of South Africa and also near Newfoundland off the coast of Canada. When I spoke to Professor Shauna Murray from the University of Technology Sydney, who is one of the lead authors of this research, which I have to say she's at pains to say is still undergoing peer review. This is the first time that it's been identified in Australia, but I asked her and I said, well, look, does this mean that it's newly arrived? And she said, we don't know because we haven't been, you know, done the research 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But she said anecdotally, she suspects that it may have been here perhaps, as she put it, all along, because it's found in, you know, disparate areas around the globe so far.
Mm-hmm. And how did the scientists actually figure out that this could be the culprit?
It took them so much work. It's been, a team of, you know, dozens of people working, and as they've said, they've done this work within 5 or 6 months, and you know, on a usual timescale, they would expect to take, you know, this could take 2 or 3 years to get these results. And so they've been getting samples from, I think it's 39 places around the state, you know, sampling again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And a big shout out, she said, to some citizen scientists who have spent Saturday after Saturday straining the algal and the samples, you know, so that then they could culture them in the lab and finally identify which of the Karenia species it was that they were dealing with and that are producing these brevetoxins. And what it also told them is that this has also been this species, this Karenia cristata, has been the dominant species within the bloom for most of its life. But it's an expanding and moving thing. So, you know, occasionally of the five species, one other one might be dominant in an area or for a little while. But this one apparently has been most dominant for most of the time.
And the bloom seems, well, it has been so devastating for industries, like you said, oyster farmers, for tourism, for so many people that rely on the coast. How hard has it been for scientists and for journalists like yourself to try and communicate this complicated science when people are wanting answers?
It's been, and this was, again, this is one of the questions I put to Professor Murray, you know, to say she must get so frustrated with, you know, people like myself who, you know, we kind of want the easy answer. And it's just the algae itself is such a complex organism. It's changing and it's evolving. You've got multiple species doing multiple things. And I really admire the scientists and the way that they have to try and communicate what's going on and to try to do it in a way that, you know, people like ourselves who don't have a scientific background can at least understand and, you know, and build from that. But I will say that the research that has been done by Professor Murray is available online if people want to go and read the paper. And if they just Google, you know, Karenia and Australia, it comes up.
so much work done behind the scenes. And where are we at now? What happens now that we have this information about the cause of the brevetoxins in that bloom?
The South Australian government has been holding weekly press conferences or updates about the bloom for some time now. And so they were asked today, you know, would they be changing their messaging? And they have said that they will not be. Mm. Because they already knew that the brevetoxins were being generated. Mm. They just didn't know the source of them. What Professor Murray said to me is this really is just the start of things. So they've done all this work for 6 months and it's almost like this has gotten to the starting block of now we know what we're dealing with. Now we need to find out as much as we can about this algae, how it produces the brevetoxins, how long they stay within certain shellfish. That seems to change. It seems as they might stay longer in guapippies rather than in oysters. So you feel like, yeah, this is really the start of trying to learn more and understand about this bloom, which we've already been living with for, gosh, over 6 months.
Oh, and it's just the beginning. As you said, it seems like even though we've had this breakthrough, it's just the very beginning.
Yeah, that's right. And this one of the things that Professor Murray wanted to emphasise is that from this, what she's hoping to do is try and develop some sort of easy or easier used way of monitoring and testing for this algae. And she said in the future it's going to be really important, not just in South Australia but also the rest of the country, because now we know that it's here and that it's been able to bloom. Yeah, there needs to be some sort of way to be able to test for it. And so, yeah, there's a lot of work that's going to be done by a lot of researchers in the coming years.
Well, Caroline, we appreciate you deciphering it for us this afternoon on Australia Wide. Thank you so much for that update.
Thank you.
Caroline Horn, our reporter from Victor Harbour.
ABC Australia Wide.
Now to southern Queensland, and having a baby should be one of the happiest times of your life. But for many mothers on the Darling Downs, it's become a time of anxiety and worry. Mothers are concerned about staff turnover at the Toowoomba Base Hospital, which includes the resignation of two directors of obstetrics and the midwifery unit manager. Ellie Bradfield has more.
Preparing for her third baby should be a joyful time for Grace. But instead, she's worried about the quality of care she will receive at the Toowoomba Base Hospital.
I did raise it with my husband and I said, like, this is not great. Like, I was already not feeling super stoked about, you know, using the service again. But to have it that the leadership is kind of a bit uncertain at the moment, definitely it increases the uncertainty I'm feeling, or the apprehension I'm feeling towards the birth.
She didn't want to use her real name due to concerns about repercussions during her care. An independent workplace culture review is underway at the hospital's maternity unit after complaints about workplace culture. The ABC understands two directors of obstetrics have resigned and the midwifery unit manager, director of nursing and midwifery, and two other senior midwives are on leave. Grace says this comes on top of fears about returning to the hospital after the birth of her second child in 2021, when she raised concerns for 5 days about her unborn baby's low heart rate and low fetal movements.
He was born with an APGAR of 4 and required CPAP for assistance to breathe. I can't really recall that moment very well, to be honest. I remember there was just a lot of movement in the room, you know, everyone just kept telling me everything's all right, but at the same time I was having some complications with a bleed, and my husband's concern was in two places: for our son, who we weren't hearing cry yet, and then me on the other hand. I just remember feeling like this is a long time for him not to be crying, and that was quite nerve-wracking.
Her son made a full recovery, but the extent of their experience didn't hit until years later when deciding whether to have more children.
I guess that's when it really kind of reared its head. Wow, like I wasn't listened to. This is what occurred. This could have potentially could have been avoided if my fears were listened to. It was definitely the main factor in terms of whether we did go for another child or not. Wasn't so much a cost of living question, it wasn't impact to employment question, it was whether I was comfortable with going through another pregnancy and wondering whether I had the confidence to speak up for my care.
In the past week, the ABC has spoken to two other women who also expressed concerns about their maternity care at the Toowoomba Hospital.
It's concerning, it's disappointing, it's disheartening.
Alicia Staines is the founder of maternity lobby group, Maternity Consumer Network, and says a huge amount of work has been done to focus on respectful maternity care in the last 5 years.
Showing good leadership that they actually are trying to improve the place. So, you know, like moving towards respectful maternity care, which is a goal of the woman-centred care strategy. We know it's been mentioned over and over again as a way to mitigate birth trauma. Now, if you get rid of all those staff that are trying to lead, you haven't got much left.
She described the resignations as a slow unravelling of strong leadership she's witnessed at the hospital.
Well, I guess the biggest one is we go back to a bygone era where it was one of the worst performing maternity services in the state. And that's according to Queensland Health's own data when they were surveying women.
Darling Downs Health Chief Executive Annette Scott said in a statement that there was no impact on the quality, safety and continuity of care and service delivery provided at the Toowoomba Maternity Unit. She says all leadership roles have been filled and the focus remains on delivering safe, high-quality, women-centred care while fostering workplace culture. Ultimately, Grace says she and her husband decided to add to their family and they're focused on bringing a healthy baby into the world.
Because for us, it's, you know, that's our family plan. We want more children and it would be a shame to let an adverse experience, you know, keep us from, like, the lifelong joy of another child. And I would hope that I'm tenacious enough to deal with whatever comes. Hopefully it'll be a better experience.
Toowoomba Mother Grace, ending that report by Ellie Bradfield.
ABC Australia Wide.
Let's head to southern Western Australia now, where a farmer has taken a fight in her late husband's name all the way to Canberra. Liz Hegarton's husband, Craig, took his own life while receiving treatment for prostate cancer. She says more needs to be done to support people going through treatment. Kate Forrester has the story. And a warning, this story contains references to suicide.
West Australian farmer Liz Hegarton is on a mission.
I just really want to drive this further, to drive this awareness and make the politicians of our day stand up and be accounted.
Hailing from Kojonup, south of Perth, Liz describes herself as an accidental advocate for prostate cancer, a role she never expected after losing her husband Craig last year to suicide following his cancer battle.
So Craig was actually diagnosed with prostate cancer when he was 56, which is relatively young, and he had to undergo a radical prostatectomy. He was considered to be cancer-free at that time, and because there were clear margins on his pathology post-op. Unfortunately, though, 4 years later, his PSA, which is prostate-specific antigen, started to rise, and they decided that he needed to have a PET scan, and unfortunately, he was then diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer.
After his diagnosis, Craig began radiation treatment, along with androgen deprivation therapy, which is also known as ADT, a hormone treatment commonly used for men with advanced prostate cancer.
Yes, so ADT, it's been the frontline treatment for people with secondary prostate cancer now for over 50 years, apparently. It is very effective, and we certainly don't want men to stop taking ADT. But in Craig's case, it absolutely messed with his mental well-being, and it was like he just slipped into the abyss. He didn't have the ability to call for help. It was just destroying him from within.
The treatment can cause serious side effects, including depression and extreme fatigue. Liz spoke about her and Craig's experience on the ABC TV show Australian Story earlier this year, hoping other families navigating the same journey will be better prepared than she was.
To be honest, I've just been blown away with how many messages I've had post the Australian Story from people I don't know, just saying thank you for shedding light on something that is so prevalent. I mean, 4,000 men will be commenced on ADT this year. That is 4,000 men and their families that are actually going to walk this journey of, they really need support. And so definitely people have been really grateful for the fact that I am shedding light on something that is so prevalent.
Liz is also determined to spark change at the highest level. She's now travelled to Parliament House in Canberra, lobbying politicians for greater awareness and more funding for prostate cancer.
To push the agenda of please, please start taking this disease, this deadly disease, more seriously, and please start funding it adequately.
The farmers also joined forces with Anne Savage, who's the head of Prostate Cancer Australia. Anne says the government needs to invest more in research and ensure mental health support is a key part of treatment alongside ADT.
To talk about the impacts of ADT before they begin the treatment, so that they go in with their eyes wide open and so that they have access.
The CEO of the Prostate Foundation says they've made progress in increasing survival rates in Australia of prostate cancer, but more can still be done. And to get it done, it needs political intervention.
We've called on the government to do several things, including the expansion of our life-saving prostate cancer specialist nursing service and the expansion of that service in particular into Australian regional communities. We've also called on the government to step up radically its support for prostate cancer research and clinical trials.
A federal government spokesperson told the ABC they're doing everything possible to support people with prostate cancer, their families and their carers, including funding a range of programs. But back here in rural WA, farmer Tony Seabrook has faced his own battle with the disease. And his advice? It's pretty simple. Just get tested.
And the cohort that I'm a part of are the baby boomers, and it's ripped through almost all of my friends, rural friends, in a very aggressive way. But there's another cohort coming forward, and these are the kids of my generation. I have no idea why it seems to assail country people much more than those in the city. But I really am happy to do this talk with you because I need to get to the younger fellas to say, you're not bloody immune, you're not bulletproof. It cleaned out a heap of my friends in my age group. It will probably come at you, and you need to be very sort of observant about the fact that it can happen, and if you get on it early, it's not a drama.
By speaking out, WA farmers like Tony Seabrook and Liz Hegarton hope their personal stories can make a real difference for the wider community.
It's a tragic, tragic story. Honestly, at the onset of me speaking out, it was about if I save one life, I've done something great. And I don't doubt that I've done that. So, yeah, I think Craig would be extremely proud. And now I'm going to get emotional, but I think he would be extremely proud of where we're heading with it.
Liz Hegarton ending the story from Kate Forrester in Western Australia. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Off to the high seas of New South Wales now, and is it possible to be excited by timber samples? In the case of shipwrecks, the answer is a very big yes. Archaeologists working to unravel the history of a shipwreck exposed on Ballina's Shelley Beach in northern New South Wales in March have used a cubic centimetre of wood taken from the artefact to try and unravel the mystery.
We sent one of our wreck spotters up to have a look at it, and he recorded the wreck for us, and we subsequently got some timber samples done of the wreck. The timber samples made it a lot more exciting.
That's senior marine archaeologist Brad Duncan from Heritage New South Wales. It was speculated the artefact was from the Comet, a wooden paddle steamer wrecked on the Richmond River Spit in 1890. Dr. Duncan says that theory changed following the work of wood specialist Hugo Illich.
Trees grow, as you know, with a main stem, which is a vertical trunk. When you take a sample out of that trunk, there's grain that runs along the length of the trunk and then the grain that runs across that. And so you look at a chunk of wood, determine the grain orientation, then look at the end grain. It needs to be looked at in such a way that you can expose the cellular structure. And so that's what we look at, the cells and their distribution.
Timber expert Hugo Illich. Brad Duncan thinks the timber has come from the northern hemisphere.
The timber samples that we had that came back was birch, larch and white oak. And that's fortuitous in it. It tells us that it's come from temperate climates. Luckily, we have a database that we can go back to and, you know, have a look at what's wrecked in those areas. And so it's given us about 13 possibilities for different wrecks. There's 6 from USA, 4 from Canada and 3 from the UK. And that's likely to have occurred sometimes between 1850s and the 1870s. It would have been a sailing vessel. The timber itself indicated that if it's come from North America, that it's likely to come from the east coast of North America. So we're talking Nova Scotia, Maryland, Brunswick, Maine. The other possibility that we've got is that it's also potentially from UK. It's probably a vessel that's either wrecked on the bar at Ballina, and it's subsequently broken up and this piece is washed ashore at the time, and it's been uncovered with the big east coast lows and cyclonic winds and seas that we've had.
The wreckage drew hundreds of curious people to the beach in the wake of Tropical Cyclone Alfred in March, prompting Ballina Shire Council and Heritage New South Wales to act quickly to rebury the timbers. Curator and manager of the Ballina Naval and Maritime Museum, Ron Krieber, says he thinks the timbers found on the beach could have broken off a larger section of wreckage still lodged in an offshore reef.
That was my thought, because people were ringing me up and saying it's floating in. Well, if it's a shipwreck item that's saturated and been sunk for all that time, it's not going to float, but the current would sort of push it. And I believe that it's come off the point. I think there's probably more wreckage there, and the southerly buster that came up has broken it off because it was freshly broken in places.
Brad Duncan says more work needs to be done to conclusively solve the mystery.
It's a bit like doing a jigsaw puzzle where you've got, you know, the box that's missing and half the pieces are gone. And so, you've got to try and use, you know, scientific methods, archaeological methods, historical documentation, etc., to try and work out, you know, what these vessels may be. And it's difficult with this one because we've only got a small section of the hull. And so, you know, if something else is found later on, we could match the timber samples potentially up to being from the same source as that. And, you know, there may be a bigger site offshore, which is what I suspect.
You're probably one of the few people who would welcome these sorts of weather events.
It's not ideal for the wrecks. From our perspective, it's not a good thing for the wrecks because, you know, they're better off being under the sand or owning them, having a bit of them exposed. But from a perspective, a research perspective, yeah, it's like Christmas. It's, you know, when you have these things exposed and they've never been known of before. And you think of the occupation in these areas, you know, people have been in these areas for 150 years and never seen it before. So it's a real opportunity to be able to get in there and have a look at what's there. And like I said, the locals are happy as Larry when a new wreck shows up on their shore. People coming from miles around to see it.
Reporter Hannah Ross there from Ballina.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Jessica Hinchliffe here on Australia Wide. Now we're off to an ancient volcano. There's certainly no lava or explosions happening in Mount Gambier's Valley Lake these days, but it's now a hotspot of a very different kind, drawing crowds from around the country for a sport called disc golf. Sam Bradbrook has this story from South Australia.
It has 18 holes, follows a set outdoor course, and is played in groups. But it's not quite golf. it's disc golf. And in Mount Gambier, South Australia, a tournament called the Eruption is one of the country's most difficult. It's played in an ancient volcanic crater.
This course is really challenging because of the wind. It just swirls and comes from every direction. Like every hole you can have a headwind on, every hole you can have a tailwind on. It's all different.
Disc golfer Riley Pedler has travelled the 2,000 odd kilometres from the Sunshine Coast in Queensland to play the Eruption.
It's the best disc golf event in Australia. Something to look forward to every year. Good course, put on a good show. It's just, yeah, good fun, very social.
The Valley Lake is believed to have erupted between 4,000 and 6,000 years ago, making it the most recent eruption in Australian history. The disc golf course winds around the Valley Lake precinct, taking in parts of the waterway as well as the rolling hills around the crater.
This year we've got 196 participants, which compares probably about the same as last year. But yeah, they're coming from all over Australia. But we've also got some internationals who live in Australia, so they're playing as well.
Michelle Schultz is the tournament director of the Eruption. Michelle says the sport of disc golf took off during the pandemic. It was one of the few that could still be played with social distancing rules. This event has gone from fewer than 100 players to almost double in the past 5 years.
You know, we're forever getting new people come out and try the sport. Like, even locals who've never heard of it think that the baskets are rubbish bins. So, and, you know, explaining how it all works. So, yeah, it's good to see even some spectators out who are just locals seeing it for the first time.
Disc golf involves groups throwing a frisbee down a course with the aim of sinking it into the basket instead of a hole. Michelle says it appeals to a wide range of people.
It's for anyone. Anyone, doesn't matter about age, you know, it's inclusive, always like a great bunch of people. Yeah, it's just fun. So we've got pros out here playing. They're playing for cash, amateurs, and, you know, they're playing for prizes.
The Eruption is South Australia's major tournament. Each state and territory hosts their own before a national final. This year, it'll be played in Perth. And while disc golf at the Eruption is good fun, Riley says it doesn't mean it's easy.
Like, it's also rated Australia's hardest course. So, yeah, a lot of people come for that challenge. Yeah, it's one of the must-play courses, must-play tournaments in Australia. It's up there.
Sam Bradbrook reporting there from Mount Gambier's Valley Lake with additional production by Josie Sargent. And finally, what does a beaver and a full moon have in common? It's two words you wouldn't expect to find in the same sentence very often, a beaver and a moon. But if you look up into the sky tonight, you may just see the beaver moon. It's set to appear at nightfall, and if the skies are clear, you may be able to see it. Astrophysicist Dr. Brad Tucker from Australian National University is very excited about its arrival.
The beaver name actually just happens to be the monthly name from the Northern Hemisphere. So in a lot of cases, historically in farming and agriculture, the monthly full moons were given names. So last month's moon was the harvest moon, because in October, that's kind of harvest season. This time, beavers, they start to come out and build their dams. So some become less relevant for us, right? It could be the platypus moon. I mean, next month's moon is the snow moon. There's also people are talking about what we call it's a super moon. And this happens because the moon, the orbit of the moon isn't a perfect circle. It varies by over 40,000 kilometers, which is quite a bit. And so sometimes it's at its closer point in its orbit, what we call perigee. And when that happens, it's a bit closer to Earth in this case, it's just shy of 30,000 kilometers. And so if it's closer to the Earth, it can look bigger and therefore look brighter in the sky. And that's where a lot of people like that superness of it, because it can look spectacular or even more so in the sky. Peak fullness closeness is at 11:19 p.m. tonight. You really want to see it after sunset. So after sunset is really the best time to see it. And that's because in order for the moon to be full, it needs to be on the opposite side of the Earth to the sun, so that the sun lights up the entire surface. So that means that as the sun is setting in the west, the moon will be rising in the east. But when it's rising on the horizon, you also get those effects of it looking big.
Astrophysicist Dr. Brad Tucker from ANU there. And good luck seeing it tonight if you're lucky and you have clear skies at your place. And that's Australia Wide for today. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. And you can always email us too. We'd love to hear what's happening in your part of the world. AustraliaWide.radio@abc.net.au. I'm Jessica Hinchliffe. Thanks for listening.